5 minutes after one on this beautiful February 26th, Tuesday. With us, we have Senator Cowdery online, Senator Wilken, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Elton. I'm Senator Kukesh, and today we're going to have a hearing to discuss the financial implications of the Juno Road project and other statewide transportation needs. As proposed, DOT would build a 50-mile road along Lynn Canal with a new ferry terminal and two new ferries to connect travelers to Haines and Skagway. DOT estimates this road will cost $374 million, making it one of the most expensive projects currently in the statewide transportation program. The section of this road with the most difficult terrain has yet to be analyzed. At the time of decline in revenues, federal revenues, the state must evaluate carefully its transportation priorities. Given the cost of this project, I'm concerned that this is not the best use of our limited transportation dollars, particularly in light of the fact that the Juno Road relies on ferry links and does not provide a hard link to our nation's highways. We have an excellent panel of witnesses today. Jeff Otteson, Director of Statewide Planning at DOT, Robert Dugan from Golder Associates, by teleconference, Mark Gable from Washington State DOT, who oversees the Washington State Sophisticated Cost Estimation Work, Mayor Kurt Menard of the Mat-Su Borough by teleconference, and Avis Thompson of the Alaska Truckers Association by teleconference to discuss his organization's priorities. Due to time constraints, I'm requesting that each speaker limit their remarks to 10 minutes to allow time questions from the committee, except, of course, for if we have to go over, that's fine. I want everybody to know that we're going to be meeting from 1 to 3 today. There will be no public testimony. It's a final financial overview and not a hearing for a decision. With that, I'd like to open up today and to, so everybody will know what the order we're going to go in, and we'll have an overview by the Department of Transportation, Jeff Otteson and Mel Menzies first, followed by Golder and Associates, then Mark Gable from the Washington State DOT, followed by Kurt Menard, Mayor, Mat-Su Borough, and finally Avis Thompson from the Alaska Truckers Association. With that, I'd appreciate it if the Department of Transportation, Jeff Otteson and Mel Menzies would come forward. And please, for the record, if you would just state your name and affiliation, please.
Senator Cowdery.
Yes, Senator Cowdery, I did recognize that you were online, and thank you for being here. Did you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I had a comment, you know, the other day on that bill that we had on youth traveling on airlines.
Yes, sir.
I'd asked, and I talked to airlines, and they're not really enthused about it, so if we bring it up again, I think we should have the airlines set.
Okay, thank you. We do have that scheduled for next Thursday, so in between now and then, we'll make sure our staff contacts the airlines for comments. Thank you, Senator Cowdery. With that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to State DOT.
Senator Kukesh, thank you for having us here. If you don't mind, I'd like to go over a quick overview of the project so that we're...
Your name and...
I'm sorry, sir. My name is Malcolm A. Menzies. I'm a resident of Juneau. I'm the director of Southeast Region, DOT and PF.
Great. Thank you very much.
For those of you who are not Southeasterners and are not very familiar with the project, I thought I'd bring along a map that shows the total area and the area that we have looked at. Juneau, of course, is down here. The project begins at the end of present Glacier Highway, approximately 40 miles from Juneau, and the road portion of the project ends at mile 90, or 50 miles of road construction. At that point, shuttle ferries would be taken to Haines and to Skagway from here. When the original EIS started, we looked at projects going up Taku Valley, going up the west side of Lynn Canal, and we're trying to connect completely with the Alaska and the Canadian highway system, or the national highway system through Canada, to Whitehorse Haines Junction and on to interior Alaska. This is another view of the project area. You can see that we have divided the project into zones. These are construction zones that we have looked at throughout the east side of Lynn Canal. Below in the lower right-hand corner is the construction cost as estimated in 2007 of the project in total. The total construction, as you can see, including the ferries, is $334,000 with $16,000 mitigation for a total project cost of $350,000.
Excuse me.
$350 million, excuse me.
Yeah, you're already off.
Damn that decimal point. engineers have all had trouble with decimal points. Here's another picture of the project area. It's a Google Earth picture. For those that don't read direct contour maps, it gives a good example of Lynn Canal, of the mountain system that we're working adjacent to and along with and all the way up to the Cassaheen River. You can see where the road starts at the end of Glacier Highway, going along the southerly side and easterly side of Berners Bay up to two major bridge crossings. Each of these two bridges are approximately a half mile in length, as is the Cassaheen Bridge in the project. The project purpose and need has not changed since the project was presently conceived approximately 1993. The purpose is to provide transportation corridor, provide flexible and improved opportunities for travel, reduce the travel time between communities and within the state of Alaska to our capital, reduce state costs for the transportation corridor, and in that we're talking road versus ferry, and reduce user costs for the transportation corridor. The roadway itself would be two 11-foot travel lanes, two 4-foot shoulders that would act as biking lanes, and it will be a paved road at when it's completed. The initial construction will be a gravel surface road. The project as we know it today started in 1994, and these are a list of the milestones that we have had through the project. I will not go over all of these, but the project has been approved by Governor Knowles first, Governor Murkowski second, and now we're working within the administration on this project. We have gone through major approvals throughout the project. We've had local government approvals, and that we are currently waiting on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers permit for this project. We are expecting that permit next month after 2 years of working on it. And these are further application and critical dates for the project per se. The support we have the two resolutions from the CBJ Assembly. We have a State House and Senate resolution. We're very thankful to receive $45 million from state funds for construction from the 2006 legislature. And we, in the supplementary draft EIS, we had 1,600 comments back with 60% favoring the road. This type of construction has been criticized by many. And what many forget is that in 1975 in Southeast Alaska, we did a project that was a real tough project that wasn't overly criticized by the public, but it was the building of the Klondike Highway, or connecting Skagway with the National Highway System, Whitehorse and Point South and North. I just bring this slide forward to show you the mountainous type terrain that we had to work in with our drilling equipment, the type of rock slopes that we had to work with, and the size of the boulders, and we call them mega boulders. The transportation planning issues for Lynn Canal, we're mandated to work on this project, and Jeff will take over from here.
Thank you, Mel. For the record, Jeff Otteson, Director of Program Development, but essentially the Director of Statewide Planning. It's the old title. And I want to give you a planning and a financial perspective on the project now that Mel has introduced the basic facts. Before I get into it, I'd like to point out, I think, one key difference about this project. This project is self-financing. This project, unlike any other project we can point to, is going to pay for itself and avoid state cost. If we were to build a major project in Mat-Su or in Anchorage, there will be substantial user benefits. Those benefits are found in the form of time savings, travel savings, accident savings, and they're all accrued by the users. None of those benefits flow to the state directly. And it sometimes makes it hard to finance projects because there is no feedback loop where the benefits can then be used to pay for new construction. That's not the case with the Lynn Canal Highway. This is one project among many that is self-financing, and you'll see that here in the coming numbers. Let me just put one set of numbers before you. In the EIS, it shows that this project, along with a couple other small improvements, leads to the need or the ability to reduce our ferry fleet by two mainline ferries. If I look at the mainline ferries operating in Southeast Alaska in the past year, I look at the two least expensive ferries, the ones that cost the least, they add up to almost $19 million a year. And then if I look at the replacement cost, which we're facing sometime in the near term, and everyone's talking about the need to replace these ferries because of their age, well, the planning estimates for mainline ferries was about $250 million a copy. So two ferries at 250 is $500 million, $20 million, $18 million a year, say over 10 years is another $200 million. You easily can come to numbers that will dwarf the cost of this one proposed highway project. This truly is a self-financing project if you look at it in that light. According to my slides, I wanted to talk to you a little about DOT's purpose. Why are we so hard over about building roads? People sometimes criticize us and say, well, we have a water road. Why do we need a highway? Why do we need a land road? This is our purpose, established in statute. It's been in place for almost the entirety of statehood. DOT's purpose is to build a network of highways that link together our cities and communities throughout the state, that aid in the extraction and utilization of our resources. So what this means is building a road that may benefit a mine isn't a negative, it's a positive. It's what our founding fathers wanted us to do, and it remains on the books today. This is also consistent with our Constitution, which talks about in Article 8 in Sections 1, 2, and 5, it talks about using our natural resources, using our lands for settlement, and building the public facilities necessary to make that happen. So that's our foundational purpose as an agency. If you talk a little bit about the planning process, this has probably been one of the most planned projects in our state history. If you talk to some people like Mel, who was with the department back in the 70s, I suspect his hair was not quite as gray. He was working on this project then, and it's been off and on and off and on. But for the last four administrations, this project has been found in transportation plans. It has been identified as one of the ways to meet the demand in this corridor in a more cost-effective manner. So it's not a Johnny-come-lately. It's not something that jumped up on the table in the last administration. It's been around for a long time. Even the 1994 EIS actually began under the Hickel administration, continued under the Knowles administration, and then continued again under the Murkowski administration. So I know there's a lot of talk, too, about fiscal constraint. And, Mr. Chairman, your comments at the start of the presentation suggested that fiscal constraint may be a concern here. And so let's put this on the table and speak to it. We have made adjustments in the project's financial schedule, taking it from a five-year project to a 12-year project in order to reduce that fiscal impact of the project. Now, I honestly think that that may be the wrong decision. And why is it the wrong decision? I think it's the wrong decision because the benefits that I talk about can't be achieved until we build the project. And those benefits are significant and will continue in perpetuity. But for the time being, in order to minimize impacts on the rest of the state, we're proposing that we slow the pace of the work to about a little more than $20 million a year over 12 years, and the rest of the money adds up in inflation. When you add the 4% inflation to those numbers, you come up with a $350 million number. The amount of money being proposed here going to one project in Southeast region is well within historic norms. Historically, about 20% of the STIP has been spent in Southeast Alaska. This represents, as you'll see in a later slide, about 7% of the STIP. So it's not an historically large amount of money being spent on one project in the smallest of our three regions. It's well within that 20% average allocation over time. You go to this slide, back up this one here, the slide with the circles here, Mel. The number here is, this is the cost of the ferry system on the left as opposed to the cost of operating and maintaining the highway system. We now spend more money to operate the ferry system, this is excluding capital on both cases, than we spend to operate the highway system. Yet at the same time, the highway system is delivering 99.5% of total travel in the state, measured as what is known as vehicle miles of travel. The entire ferry system is only delivering about 0.5% of vehicle miles of travel. So go to the next slide. What does that mean in terms of how much it costs the state? Back up. But just one there.
Edit? Yeah. Let me just...
Okay, at the top of that slide, you see a key fact. The state cost to transport a vehicle on a highway is currently about 2 cents a mile. That is what it cost us to maintain the highway system and to allow those vehicles to use the system. The state cost to transport a vehicle on our ferry system is about $4.50 a mile. This is the fundamental cost difference between ferries and roads, and it's what drives us to say, if we can shorten the ferry links and lengthen the road links, we will achieve a more cost-effective system. And I would suggest to you that a cost-effective system is best for the region because it's a sustainable system. It's a system that's affordable, not only in rich years like we have today, but in the lean years that we've all seen from time to time in the budget process. So those numbers are starkly different, and I would ask you that you keep those in mind. This is a comparison of revenue and cost in the marine highway system as a total system in the past few years. And what you see here is that the ferry system has gone to about two-thirds of its costs being covered by revenue to about one-third of its costs being covered by revenue. That change has all happened really in the last 3 or 4 years. It's instructive that these high costs have occurred just in the recent past because the Juneau Access EIS was prepared just before those high costs kind of crept into the picture. So any analysis we did then doesn't really reflect these new high costs that have occurred in the marine highway system. So even though the EIS was positive in terms of the roads economics, these costs only suggest that it would be more positive today than it was then. So a hard look at the numbers. Over the next 12 years, which is the time period we're proposing to take to build this project, the Lynn Canal Highway System will require about $350 million, inflation adjusted. And that's per the latest financial plan, and that's with inflation built into the estimate out to the 12th year. At the same time, the Marine Highway System, which is really the alternative in that corridor, will require over $2 billion after revenue is accounted for. Now, the Marine Highway System covers a lot more than Lynn Canal, but I just want to put it in perspective because when we talk about cost, we have a much bigger cost factor that we're dealing with here for the whole system. This is the only project queued up and ready to go that offers cost savings for marine highways. There's not another project in the state that offers meaningful cost reduction to the Marine Highway System cost but Lynn Canal Highway. So that much money, $2 billion in the next 12 years, is equivalent to building 6 Juneau Access projects, or 66% of the urban highway needs in both Anchorage and Fairbanks that have been identified, or 33% of all the strategic highway needs identified statewide. It's a significant number, and it deserves to be brought forward, because if we can manage it, if we can reduce it, and at the same time offer people actually a better travel option, I think we've made the right choice, Mr. Chairman.
Could I just have a clarification? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff, could you go back to that, please? Does after revenue, is that the same as meaning, the hard look?
I'm sorry, this.
Well, I can just ask you. The after revenue, does that mean state subsidy? Is that what we know today as our $100 million subsidy?
That's essentially the subsidy. That's the what we did is we took the annualized cost of the ferry system, which we just identified in the 2030 plan. We subtracted revenue from that. And we said, what's that going to cost over the next 12 years? Well, it's a number of about $2 billion. It's a significant number.
Okay. So that's the state subsidy. And the $2 billion isn't just Juneau-Lynn Canal. That's total marine
that's
highway?
That's total marine highway system. Okay. And I need to point that out. We can't save the full $2 billion. But I can show you that those numbers are becoming significant, and because we've all heard the cost of the next set of ferries is going to be upward of $200, $250, $300, I've even heard $350. These are all planning estimates. No one's really sat down with a naval architect and costed it, but they're going to be significant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bilton has a question for you.
To follow up on the question by Senator Wilkin, I mean, if you've done the comparison for the whole marine highway system, I mean, have you broken it out for the Lynn Canal component of the marine highway system versus the Lynn Canal highway?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, we, at this point, I didn't, but we have done it in EIS. The only thing that's changed is the cost is rising for everything the Marine Highway System does, just like the cost is rising for the cost of construction for our highway program. They're rising about the same, so you really can't say, well, one has risen so that we ought to then look at the other. But I can say this, the Juneau Access Lynn Canal Highway Project is proposed to reduce the need for two mainline ferries. And from my opening comments, you can just do some simple math and come up with a number that is far higher than the cost of Lynn Canal Highway.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Maybe I'm misunderstanding your answer, Mr. Otteson, but it does seem to me totally unfair to compare the cost of the Lynn Canal Highway to the whole Marine Highway System. And it would seem to me that a better apples-to-apples comparison would be what the cost is to run ferries in Lynn Canal versus what the cost of the highway system in.
We can get to that number. And I'm not trying to suggest that the Lynn Canal Highway changes that picture. What I am trying to point out is the costs have risen dramatically for that system, and we have only one project across the entire state that can make a difference in those costs. So if we're going to attack those costs, and I think to achieve sustainability, that would be a goal, this is one project and begin to reduce those costs. We're gonna bear those costs in other ways in other parts of the state. But a sustainable system will be one that is affordable to the state in the lean years as well as the rich years.
If, Mr. Chair, I'm not a member of the committee, so I appreciate your forbearance.
Well. If
in fact the department does provide that direct Lynn Canal ferries versus Lynn Canal highway cost, I'd be interested in a copy of it.
Well,
also.
Actually, as a chairman, I'm going to ask you to do that, because I really think it's unfair too to take the whole Alaska Marine Highway budget and use this comparison. It's not fair, and I'm telling you as a chairman of the committee now that I want to see that breakdown. If you would,
I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And I didn't do it to be unfair. I did it to draw attention that we have a system that, for a series of reasons, has become expensive, and it's facing. We're at the cusp. We're at that decision point in the road. Do we continue to and do it again for the next 50 years? Or do we make a difference and we begin to go to the day boat concept that's been identified in so many of our planning products and actually achieve the day boat concept? Mm-hmm. And that is really the fork in the road that we stand at as a state.
And I understand that, but I want people who are not sitting in this committee room or are familiar with it to see your comparison and think that's the whole picture.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
So I won't stress this one just because we've already discussed it. But I think another question to ask, and a fair question to ask, is what happens if the cost of the Lynn Canal Highway goes up above what it is today, the estimate of $350 million? And now you heard a number at the opening of $374 million. The difference in those two numbers is the $24 million is a sunk cost. It's the cost that's already been spent to date getting through the EIS and the permitting process. So those are costs that have already taken place in the past. And they aren't different numbers. They're the same number. 350 is the dollars that we're still have a choice over. We have dominion over. But construction costs have gone up, and if you see my other presentations here in the building, I've talked about that. They've gone up dramatically, but so have the costs for the Marine Highway System. In other words, the costs are really driven by the same fundamental factors in the economy. The cost of energy, the cost of steel, etc., are all changing our cost environment. It's not realistic to assume that road costs will rise alone. In other words, I don't believe that if the road costs go up, the cost of the Marine Highway System will somehow be protected from those same cost factors. So they're both likely to continue to go up. But only the Lynn Canal Highway, again, offers a means of structurally reducing some part of those AMHS costs. That's, I think, the key fact. And as I said at the beginning, only the Marine Highways, or the Lynn Canal Highway, can offer to self-finance itself, because its savings actually come back to the state budget itself. So here's one that is not talked about in great detail in the environmental document, but I think is an issue that is new and of the day. That is the issue of global warming. Everything I'm hearing out of Washington, D.C. is that Congress is going to attach global warming mandates to the next highway bill. So our funding will come with it, with some mandate that we plan for and try to reduce our carbon footprint of the transportation system. And surprisingly, and I think contrary to a lot of people's conventional wisdom, is the ferry system is actually more energy intensive than is the highway. At the predicted traffic volume about 4 to 5 times higher than the ferry system. And I'm talking now about conventional ferries, not the fast, high fuel-burning fast ferries, just the older conventional style ferries. Those ferries would burn more fuel, carrying far less traffic. So if we, again, if we back off from building Lynn Canal Highway, we have left our citizens and our state budgets with a system that may well be paying a carbon tax or some other kind of punitive of cost of travel in this corridor, and we will have no way to back out of that decision. So in serving public needs, I think if you look at what this project does, it offers an opportunity for a higher level service in terms of capacity, travel time, and better frequency. It reduces in perpetuity the state cost in this corridor. That's a long time. You know, for year after year, for decade after decade, costs we're now paying can be avoided. It greatly reduces the travel costs to the traveling public. It makes travel affordable to our lowest income groups, and it helps us connect communities, resources, and economic activity consistent with both our statutory purpose and the Alaska Constitution. But if we delayed the Lynn Canal Highway, all the inverse of those things happen. And this is like if I'd come to you and said, we don't want to build the highway, we really think we ought to stick with the ferry, and here's why, I think you'd almost laugh me out of the room. That we're going to perpetuate a lower level of service with less capacity, longer travel times, reduced frequency. We're going to lock in high state costs in the corridor. We're going to perpetuate high travel costs for the public. And we're going to result in travel being unaffordable to the lowest income groups, leaving our communities less connected, and now cementing our reliance on a high carbon footprint option. That's essentially the fork in the road we face. We can pick one of those two futures. So in conclusion, we think that this decision to continue would represent a reasonable commitment of federal highway funds because it serves the express purpose and need of the corridor. It offers the only identified means of structurally reducing the rising cost of marine highways. It offers the best solution for greenhouse gas mandates that we think are coming and coming quickly. And finally, I think by reducing marine highway system costs, we achieve two quick benefits. One, we make that system more sustainable, and I believe sustainability is in its best interest, is in the region's best interest. Secondly, any avoided costs then become available for investment elsewhere in our state. And those avoided costs would be avoided costs that are being churned off year after year after year because we're making savings in perpetuity. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Okay, questions from members of the committee? Senator Elton, Senator Wilkins, Senator Cowdery.
Maybe we were going to get to this, and if so, we can just delay it until the appropriate time. Could you talk a little bit about the funding for the project, the funding for phase one, the funding for phase two, and what phase one is? I mean, a conversation that I had with Mr. Menzies a couple of days ago, it sounds to me that phase one is now a foreshortened version of what is identified in the map as zone one.
I think Mr. Menzies should answer. If the zone one is yes, it's a 5-mile segment of zone one. It's a deliberately chosen small segment because we're facing the possibility of litigation and an injunction. And so if we were to put out a larger construction contract, that contractor would have his bond capacity potentially tied up for months, if not years. So we don't want to put a contractor at a great deal of risk while we deal with this issue in litigation.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair. So that component of the project, for lack of a more technical term, eats how far into the amount of money that you now have for the entire project?
Mel, do you want to answer that?
I'm sorry.
How much is the first construction contract going to cost out of the total cost?
It's going to, Representative Elton, Senator Elton, through the chair, is estimated right now between $7 and $10 million.
And Mr. Chair, and how much do you have on hand now?
We have on hand approximately $88 million is the best number that I can think of right now.
And and if I could, Mr. Chair, and the $88 million is composed of X number of millions that are left over from the 2006 appropriation, and what?
And a federal, and a federal authorization using what's known as AC, advanced construction. It's something we do with a lot of projects. It's essentially the authority to spend state dollars and get reimbursed with federal dollars at a later date. And because this project is essentially going to hang fire until we get through the legal process, we're using AC because that doesn't tie up any real dollars. So we have money tied up, except for the state general fund dollars that are real dollars. The federal dollars that are tied up are essentially a promise. It's like a authority to spending your credit card. Until you use it, you haven't used any money at all.
And then a final question, Mr. Chair. So is the federal authority could be used on any project?
It's federal authority for the Juneau Access Project, and then we process a piece of paperwork with our federal partners that allows us to begin this project under what's known as AC, or advanced construction. And we use advanced construction on projects throughout the state in a wide range of projects for a wide range of reasons.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our computer's down, so I'll just hold this up. Would you talk a little bit about, I remember some years ago, there was discussion about a west route, and there was discussion, someone mentioned it, about the Taku River Valley route. So I'm wondering if you could just refresh my memory about this, about the alternative to go out to the west and hook up with the highway that is off of our map here.
Senator Wilkin, through the chair, the Taku route was one route that was studied through the EIS process. That route is specifically longer than the Juneau Access route or the west or the east side. It has its limitations with regard to flooding in that whole Taku Valley. And we have to get permission from the Canadians to do that. That was one thing that did not come forward, was permission with the Canadians to meet us at the border, or for us to go through the border and construct all the way through. So that was an alternative that was eventually dropped for that and many other reasons. On the west side of Lynn Canal, that project was started in 1963. Jeff said earlier, 1970. I was the original author of the first study in that particular time. At that particular time, when it was called the Juneau Haines Highway, it was for capital access. The ferry alternative wasn't at that time well thought out, except there would be a general ferry either in St. James Bay or William Henry Bay, crossing either to Berners or one other bay in the area. The problem with the ferry crossings, when they started to think it was the crosswinds that the ferry would be running through all the time. It would be, in the winter times, it would be just running perpendicular to the winds, and there would be hard problems with that. We did have many of the same problems and construction challenges and design challenges that we have on the east side today. We had on the west side, we had avalanche areas, we had areas that we felt at the time required snow sheds and things like that, so it was difficult. The final engineering item that makes the east side so much more attractive than the west side is it's a side that can hard link. We can eventually hard link to Skagway, the Klondike Highway, and the Canadian Alaskan Highway to the north. That's something that we can never do on the west side because of a ferry crossing.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could you elaborate a little more about your hard link? I understand you're going to be ending that run a long ways south of a hard link. You said eventually you would hard link to that Klondike. And
Senator Kukesh,
tell me where that came from.
Yes, we are. Environmental impact statement included many, many different options. One of the options was going all the way to Skagway and connecting to the Klondike Highway. That was and is a long-term Alaska planning goal to this project. This project is a project that it was one of the options when Skagway and the National Park Service thought there may be an invasion onto their view plane or their view shed of the Klondike National Park in Skagway. They they objected, I don't know if that's the right word, but that's the word I'll use, they objected to the project under B2, a certain section of the Transportation Act. So the project was shortened at this time to the Cassaheen River. The Cassaheen River crossing was always going to be a ferry terminal in many different options because we were always going to give this project access to Haines as well as direct access to Skagway. So therefore, we just stepped back almost 2 years ago and picked in the supplementary EIS a second option which would end this project at the Cassaheen River, requiring two shuttle ferries to Haines and Skagway. As I said, the long-term goal, years from now, more than 12 years from now, would be a second project that would go all the way to Skagway and connect to the National Highway
system. So the $350 million you have right now does not include the hard link?
No, sir, it does not.
Okay. But does the $350 million estimate include the shuttle ferries?
Yes, sir, it does.
It does, okay. I don't have a comparison, but I was wondering if you could tell me how good your estimates are. The only area that I can think of in Alaska where you might have done something is at the Whittier Tunnel. How close were your estimates on that particular project?
Mr. Chairman, my recollection is pretty vague.
It was, hey, can you just get us that?
Get you that number.
I'd like to see how good your estimations are.
That's actually a very that project is very different in terms of its characteristics.
I know it is, and I'm not looking at the scope of the project. I'm looking at the estimate, and to see how good your estimate is. Because if you're telling me $350 million, I just want to be able to believe it.
Presently, we do not have a project that large within the Southeast region, especially.
I know. That's why I was asking if you could give me some background on the Whittier project, just so I can see how good you are.
But other projects, I was going to say, in the neighborhood of 30 to 40 to 50 million, the Southeast region has been within 5% plus or minus of their construction estimate. These projects include large rock projects, heavy hauling projects such as the Ketchikan International Airport, Gravina Access, the highway, the Wrangell Airport, and the Haines Highway.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkin. I know you're pressed for time. One last question. Is the university doing some sort of a study for the state in regard to this project or state transportation priorities?
Yes, sir. As part of the mitigation for this project, we've constructed a reef, a submerged reef, in Lynn Canal at the restaurant south of Berners Bay, and that was constructed approximately 6 months to 9 months ago by a local contractor. It is part of the mitigation of the project that moved forward because all the different environmental groups that had reviewed the project asked us to go forward with that project. We also have other studies with state agencies and with federal agencies on goats, on moose, on wolf in the project area. It is determined what the population standard is for these animals in the corridor now, what it would be after construction.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Elton? Just go ahead, please.
And this may be more appropriate for the fellow from Golder, but I mean, as you did your cost estimates, I mean, how much did the Golder geotechnical investigations, how much did they inform the cost estimates that were prepared by the department?
Senator Kuchas, Senator Elton. Golder was not retained by us to do any part of the cost estimates. They are a geological consulting firm. They were retained by us to study the geology of the project in areas that we were not able to contact. We used our own geologist in zones 1, 2, and 3. We used Golder in zone 4. We still have a retaining contract with zone Golder, and they'll speak to it. Their initial geological review gave several areas of recommended alignment changes, of areas of stability studies for the road and things like that. Our designers have looked at these areas. They've made adjustments to the plan in Zone 4. We're also making adjustments in what we call Zone 1A. Our own forces, our pre-construction engineer, conducted the estimate, just finished the estimate for the 2007 financial plan, didn't just finish it in the spring, but it was based on recent work throughout the region, recent work throughout the state and Canada. We went into Canada and looked at some of their projects also. It was also based on bids that we did receive on the Pioneer Road that was built on, for Lynn Canal Highway under the Murkowski administration. That was, there's part of the road was built, the Cascade portion is the Pioneer Road. We bid two other projects forward, one we rejected and one we accepted the bids on, but the project was further rejected. Those prices were used in this estimate. The estimate went from, in very round numbers, $270 or $280 million up to $350 million between 2004 and 2007.
Mr. Chair, the reason I asked how much the Golder report may have informed the cost estimates, and I'm just going to pick something that out of the Golder report, and that may be totally unfair, and if so, you can tell me. I mean, they were talking about size of mega talus, and you don't need to define it for us, but it was one of the issues that they identified, and they said, based on the observed fragment size of the talus, there does not appear to be practical methods of retaining the talus without resorting to structural methods such as retaining walls. Therefore, cut heights in talus must be minimized by either putting the road in prism or removing the talus from the cut slope. And so the reason I asked how much the Golder report informed your cost estimate is retaining walls are an additional cost. Removing talus above the road is an additional cost. I mean, were those were reports like that from the Golder report, were those internalized as you made your cost estimates on the construction cost for the highway?
Yes, sir, they were. Golder's study made quite a few recommendations for us. But to begin their study, and you'll hear this from the gentleman for the same question, we gave them a conceptual or a very preliminary line and grade line. In that line and grade, we showed vertical cuts, straight up and cuts, and they had to comment on those cuts. That's what they did do. They said in many instances, these type of cuts won't work. You have to do retaining walls and other things. Our design staff and our pre-construction engineer looked at those. They've added about $15 million worth of retaining walls. They've moved the road inland and upwards in some areas, away from talus areas. They've moved it outwards in some areas. This is a design sequence that we go through in any particular project. We first have to have a concept of the project. We have to have a line and grade. Then we go out and do a field investigation. They did phase one, which is a reconnaissance. They did no subsurface investigation. They did only surface investigation. And they made this phase one report to us. Their next step, which will be done in a year or two, will be some subsurface exploration. Because the project is stepped out to a 12-year span instead of a 5-year span, we don't look to spend the money now. We don't spend the money now on that need until we get closer to that need. But their study did enough for us that we can adjust the design and the estimates.
There was a phase one study, and that's the Golder report from about a year ago, and there will be a phase two, but it hasn't.
It has not been authorized yet.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I don't have any more questions, but thank you very much for your presentation, and we'll hear from the Golder and Associates next. And if there's more questions, you'll be available.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. Your name and affiliation for the record, please, and we'd like to hear from you this afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I'm Bob Dugan. I'm with Golder Associates. I was a project manager for the Golder study for the Lynn Canal Highway project. And just so you know, this study was strictly to map the geology and identify the geologic hazards along Zone 4 of Lynn Canal. Just a 22-mile section from Independence Creek to Katsaheen River. Now, I don't have anything prepared. I'm not presenting anything, but I'm here to answer whatever questions y'all might have.
Yeah. And we do have a Golder. This is your report that is available in our packets.
Yes, that's, if that's a 2006, December 2006 report, that's our report. Now, we worked with DOT after the issuance of that report in very early 2007 to work with them to help try to optimize the alignment. But then pretty much the project got cut off about a year ago, and we were told not to work on it anymore, so we really haven't visited any part of this for the last year.
Okay. Any questions from a member of the committee? Senator Elk.
I'm just trying to understand your last comment. You were told not to work on it anymore. Had you completed your work, or was this prior to the completion of your report?
Yes, Senator Elton, we had completed our scope of work for what we were authorized to do up to for the mapping and the hazard identification of the preliminary geologic work on the alignment. That was completed.
And Mr. Chair, had it been your expectation that you would then begin phase two work after the completion of that component?
Yes, it had.
And so when, if Mr. Chair, so when you were told, were you given a reason on why the second step didn't follow the first step?
Well, we understood it no longer became the priority of the department, when I presumed it was probably because it was no longer the priority of the governor, but I don't know.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Wilkin. No. Senator Cowdery, any questions? If not, thank you very much for being here today. Do you have any more you'd like to add?
It's a very difficult terrain, unusual alignment, and some of the conditions along there, I think, are well described in the report and are going to take special measures to do. As for the DOT's cost, I think that their cost is still a work in progress, because there are certain segments of the alignment that do not have a finalized alignment for it yet. And I mean, if it does, I haven't seen it yet, but then I've been away from the project for a year also.
And you were only in one section of the entire project. Is that right?
Well, that's...
You didn't get a chance to go through step one all the way to the...
That's not quite true, okay. Because we did investigations at the bridge sites, several bridge sites in zones 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
So we drilled the bridges there, and we also did liquefaction studies for certain of the bridges that... had a liquefaction issue that were not founded on bedrock. So we did a little bit of work on some of the other portions of it. And I've actually briefly seen all those bridge crossings on a reconnaissance level. But we've done no other work than that. And we some of the people that do work for me did log some of the boreholes that were put at those bridges.
Go ahead.
Yes. And I apologize, because this may be I'm reading too much between the lines, but I fastened upon your comment that the budget is a work in progress. I understand that Golder wasn't contracted to provide cost estimates, but given your experience, I mean, are you optimistic about the $350 million project, or when you say it's a work in progress, do you expect it to go up or down, or that at some point in the future $350 million may be a confirmed price for the final project?
Well, it will really depend on how you can get the alignment through some of the most difficult places, which may take tunnels. So that's a, you know, that's a real possibility. And I don't think that that's been nailed down yet. Certainly it hadn't been nailed down by Golder. There are places that have a lot of large talus, very large cuts, and the pre-design alignment that we had to work with in those areas was really not feasible. Something else had to be done. And we haven't worked on that. I'm not sure that in some of these locations DOT may have a new feasible alignment, but it can also vary when you actually go out and investigate some of these sites. So to say that that is a completely hard number, no, it can't be, because there hasn't been enough real engineering work done on the alignment yet, but like I said, I think it's a work in progress, and I think DOT understands it's a work in progress also.
Senator Elton, continue.
Yeah, you saw the furrowed brow, and I'm trying to work this through. I mean, I'm assuming you have experience in different areas of the world, or perhaps Alaska, and I guess what I'm trying to get to is, are we at a point, a decision-making point, on whether we should begin spending money on a road to Katsuhin, given the question mark that you've put on some of these alignment issues and some of the issues that may be problematic that have not yet been identified?
That's probably a little out of my area expertise to know that. I think that more money will have to be spent on the engineering side of it before you will know what the cost is. That's about the best I can tell you on that. We're not charged with costing anything, so we're trying to. Our role was fairly limited in seeing what the hazards were and what the conditions were on site, and they're difficult.
And I don't want to press, and so please, you can wave your hands in the air and say you surrender if I'm going beyond where you're comfortable going. I guess I'm kind of struggling with the fact that if I were building a home and I knew how much the siding was going to cost and how much the roof was going to cost, but I wasn't sure about some of the engineering issues on the foundation, that it would be a little bit premature for me to determine whether or not to go ahead with a home without answering those foundation issues. And that may be a very poor analogy, but it's kind of what I'm hearing, and maybe it's not a good analogy, but it's kind of what I seem to be hearing from you, that we may not know enough about the foundation yet to start pricing the home and making a decision on whether or not to build a home.
I don't think we're fully there yet, no.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So perhaps talk a little bit about what other projects have you worked on that would be akin to this project?
Well, I've spent my entire professional career working in Alaska. I started working in Alaska as an engineering geologist in 1974. On the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and I have done several projects, linear projects, throughout the state, road between Cold Bay and King Cove, several transmission lines, one being Tai transmission line between Tai Lake and Petersburg, transmission line from Healy to Fairbanks, which is another 90-mile line, numerous highway upgrades in Sitka, Haines. A lot of work on material sites for DOT on the Dalton Highway. I've worked all over the state, bridges and on Alaska. So I've pretty much worked all over the state with several projects in Southeast, if that's answer to your question.
So would it be fair then to say that this is really your first look at what amounts to a rough terrain, steep terrain, people mover project?
Well, it's certainly the far and away the most extensive, longest section of new highway and virgin ground, yes. But I can't think of another instance in my time in Alaska over the last, since 1974, where they've actually tried to work with a virgin alignment anywhere near this size.
Okay. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to follow on to Senator Elton's analogy. If you're in her house and your house is falling down around your ears, and your choice is to build a new house or to repair the house you're in, and that's where we are. We are going to spend the people's money on something to improve transportation to and from Juneau, and indeed all of Southeast Alaska. So I go back to Mr. Otteson's
comments, this is very much a financial decision, and we shouldn't forget that. This isn't an access issue. This isn't a rough terrain issue. This is a, in many respects, a financial issue. So whether it's $350 million or $700 million, I'm not sure over time that really makes much difference to me. And that's not for us to talk about today, but if we try to shun this project just because we don't have all the data in front of us and aren't willing to look at that data, knowing that we need to do something to fix the transportation in and out of Southeast Alaska, then indeed we've short-sheeted all the people that are involved in this. So my comment to your analogy. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We've made decisions like that all the time. I was in the House when we made a decision about subsistence and didn't have all the background material. So thank you very much for your participation this afternoon. I'd like to ask Mr. Mark Gable, I think, is online, I believe, Washington State Department of Transportation. Mr. Gable, are you online?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Really, a little bit too much, I think. We're going to turn the volume down just
a
little bit.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I'm glad you can hear me well. I guess I would respectfully request, there's been some breakup on my end. It could just be the rain here in our area muffles everything on the transmission, but if people could speak directly into their microphones, I could hear more clearly. My name is Mark Gable. I graduated from University of Alaska Fairbanks in 1990 in civil engineering, subsequently earned my master's degree at University of Washington, Seattle. I've worked for Washington State DOT since 1991. I currently lead what we call our cost risk estimating management unit for our state. I have spoken about risk-based estimating to a number of project teams across our state and in other states, as well as at the National TRB conference in Washington, D.C. 2 years ago. Nancy Barnes emailed me four specific questions that I was asked to comment on. I can succinctly respond to each of those, and then I'm happy to answer any questions that you all may have for me. Does that sound fair?
That sounds fair, yes, and I'm sure members of the committee will have a question or two for you. Thank you.
Okay. The first question posed to me was, given that Alaska DOT has in several instances greatly underestimated road building costs, what is the benefit to Washington and other states in coming up with cost ranges? If misery loves company, I'll share with you that a lot of states are struggling with this challenge right now, us included. And the quick, short answer to that question is, we would say it's better to be approximately right rather than precisely wrong. And what we mean by that is that an early estimate in particular is more accurately expressed as a range rather than a single number. I guess I would simply say we're reclaiming the term estimate for what an estimate truly is. If we're only at 10 or 20 or 30% design, it's false precision for us to say a project's going to cost exactly this much. So that's one benefit is that we believe we're being more accurate. The second thing is we always know, and I think all of us in our industry understand, that there's two questions we're always going to be asked. How long will this project take to build and how much will it cost? And the obvious follow-up question is why? Well, through our risk-based estimating process, we're able to respond to those questions in terms of ranges and actually give explanations as to why, because we carefully document and identify the risks and characterize those risks in terms of probabilities and consequences. We have shared the same public perception sometimes that, our estimates and schedules are not to be trusted and things like that. And what we're coming out and saying is we're trying to be more open about that and say, look, when we're early on in design, there's more things that might happen than will happen, and we're doing our best to identify those uncertainties and risks for you and kind of explain the risk exposure. I do want to add one thing. When we use the term risk, at least in our risk-based estimating practice, it can be viewed as a negative or a positive. A positive consequence would present an opportunity. A negative consequence would pose a threat to project objectives. And obviously in any project, especially early on, there's going to be both. A lot of times there's probably going to be more the threat sometimes than opportunities, but both are usually available to projects. We would say that risk is not just negative impacts, but it opens new avenues of thinking, and this too has been a benefit to us. So that was kind of my response to question one. Question two was, how has our cost estimate validation process for our state's more expensive projects helped Washington determine its transportation priorities, or rather has it? And I would say yes, it has. Even though we're doing quantitative analysis, I would say sometimes the use of those results by the decision makers is more of a qualitative use of that information. And the way it fits or informs the decision makers, I would say, is that we now have a risk assessment that kind of documents the risk profile of the project. And if there's two projects competing for each other, we can kind of look at that. And then, there needs to be some self-awareness as to how much risk are we willing to tolerate? Are we more risk-averse, or are we more risk-seeking? And ultimately, when you have a situation like this, and I'm sensitive to the project where facts are uncertain, decision stakes are high, and a lot of values are in dispute, risk assessment, we would say, must be at the heart of informed decision-making. It has to be part of the overall project management process. And I'm speaking, just to clarify too, I'm just speaking, I guess, on behalf of our risk estimating process. I'm not a proponent or opponent of this project. I'm not that familiar with the project, so I'm just talking about our estimating practices here in Washington State. The third question, to the extent you have reviewed information on the Juno Road project, can you give us some guidance on how numerous hazards on road alignment might affect costs? Let me respond to it this way, kind of echo what I just said regarding to knowledge of the project and proponent or opponent. I did skim through the Golder report, which I have a copy of here, and I also viewed a DVD about the project that someone had prepared. And I would defer to those more familiar with the project, those of you have experts and engineers and scientists on site who know that project much better than I. So I don't see that I can add value in that specific area on details. But what I can offer is this. To properly ascertain the risks and hazards, I would suggest that a risk workshop of some sort is probably appropriate, and that the workshop convened should include risk experts, your cost experts, your subject matter experts. And I would say subject matter experts external to the project. That's one of the hallmarks of our cost estimate validation process. We want a few people in the room who have no dog in the fight, and they're just going to tell us what they think about a certain risk or uncertainty and its opportunities or threats, and characterize it in terms of probability and consequence. And that team should work collaboratively with the project team, of course, in a workshop setting to do these sorts of things. What can then be accomplished is through that identification and characterization of risk process, a quantitative analysis could be performed, which would reveal to the project team and decision makers a range and a probability of cost and schedule for that project. I will suggest this, that a lot of times people think that it's possible to be more precise about risk than is really feasible, especially early in a project development process. I overheard some of the using the building a house kind of metaphor there. It's interesting to use that occasionally. I will use that from on our end to try to describe people outside of our industry, why can't we predict precisely what a project's going to cost? And I would say to them, well, why don't you take a napkin and sketch your retirement house, what you think that should look like 20 years from now, and then try to predict what the cost of that will be. And a lot of times that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a lot of uncertainty risk. The further out a project is, the more uncertainty that it's exposed to, just simply because there's so many unknowns. And those unknowns become revealed over time, of course, through engineering and investigation and project development. The final question posed to me was, how does Washington State incorporate cost ranges into the STIP process? Now, I know it's very easy for me to sit here and say that an estimate is a range, and I stand by that, an estimate is a range. However, at the end of the day, we also understand that people building budgets have to stick, they're going to plug in a number. And so what we have done here for our larger projects, and we use this cost estimate validation process workshop for all projects over $100 million, and we probably probably have done, you know, I'd say maybe a couple dozen different projects like that, ranging in, you know, costs from $100 billion to several billions, where we go in and do these sorts of risk analysis workshops. The default figure that we've established on when a probability range is developed for a project is the 90 percentile figure. It's been observed to us, and I will not argue, that the 90 percentile figure can be too conservative. We acknowledge that is a possibility, but until our process, when I say our process, risk-based estimating process is more perfectly calibrated, we think it's an appropriate and comfortable figure for us. We do allow our project managers to propose a different percentile figure. There's an approval process they can go through if they think it's the 90 percentile is not the appropriate probability figure to use for budgeting, and you know, they have an opportunity to do that. One thing I want to add on the figure is that when you first do a risk-based workshop for any project, that first range of figures coming out of the workshop is going to be an unmitigated estimate range. In other words, a risk register is developed listing all of the risks that were identified and uncertainties, characterize those in terms of probabilities and impact, and then those would actually be modeled through a statistical model and ranked in terms of significance. Well, what we would like to see, and what for proactive project management then, is for the project managers to take that and go create an aggressive risk response plan and say, okay, we've identified, you know, 30 or 40 risks, but these top 7 or 10, these are the ones that are the real kicker. These are the ones we're going to have to deal with. And actually go through those and scrutinize those and say, okay, what can I do to respond to each of these risk events? Or if it's an opportunity, how can I take advantage of that opportunity? And then create basically a mitigation plan, if you will, incorporate that into your overall project management plan. You could run the analysis again and see quantitatively what the effect of your mitigation response plan would provide. And with that, I believe that brings my four responses to the questions posed to me to an end, and I'm happy to entertain any follow-up questions.
Senator Elton.
Thank you, and I'm going to ask a question that I don't think is necessarily project specific, but I think that your years at UAF could perhaps inform your answer, and certainly your experience on estimating projects in Washington State may help inform. I mean, if you look out ahead 12 years on a major project, a project of the size that we're discussing, what kind of an inflation factor would you use for those 12 years? The inflation factor that has been used by the department here is 4% inflation. I hesitate to ask whether that's fair or not, but I wonder what kind of an inflation factor you're using for projects out into the future in Washington State.
Boy, you zeroed right in on one of our touchy issues here. Enough. I'll give you as much information as I can about inflation. When we first began the CBIP process back in, I think, approximately 2002, for several years, I think we were just using a flat rate of around 3.5%. The more or less reflected a construction cost index table that we actually purchased as an agency from an organization called Global Insights. They're economic forecasters. And our program management folks, we still to this day use the Global Insights forecast. We have allowed for a little while there some uncertainty to be assigned around that inflation rate. In other words, we would say the Global Insights rate or the 3.5% or 3% rate was a base rate, so then it might be, you know, minus 1% to plus 4% or something randomly assigned, something like that. There's uncertainty, of course, with inflation. The problem with that was we were finding in our analyses we were getting, you know, there's kind of inconsistent applications of inflation, and it was difficult to explain, well, gee, why are we using this inflation rate for one project and not for another? So we have, as a state, as a standard policy set, statewide, we are going to use the standard construction cost index tables, which we purchased as an agency from Global Insights, because they're economic experts. Their figures are used by lots of folks, so that's what we're going to use. I want to add a caveat to that, though. We did allow two very large mega projects down here to do something slightly different. It's interesting you said 4%. They they used approximately 4% plus or minus 2% as a range. And so basically, there's a range of inflation. Now, for your specific situation, I guess I would probably turn to your local economic forecasters, and you mentioned the universities. Perhaps the economic department there could come together and do some analyses. I, my personal opinion, I'll just share, this is my personal opinion, it's not shared by everyone in my department and such like that, is that one of the better ways to do it is to identify whatever standard inflation rate that you want to use for this project, or if the state has a standard rate they use for transportation projects, use that, and then run the model again with a different scenario saying that same rate plus 1%. And what that'll reveal to you is the sensitivity of inflation to the projected year of expenditure cost. So for example, you mentioned 4%. If you're using 4%, fine, run the model that way, get your range of figures, but then run it again at 5%. See exactly what a 1% difference in inflation does to the estimates, just again to inform the decision makers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski, any questions for the gentleman? Senator Kyle, do you have any questions for the gentleman from Washington? If not, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. We really appreciate your input. Mr. Gable. We'll go now to Kurt Menard, who's the mayor of the Mat-Su Borough.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's been very interesting listening to the all of the testimony and stuff. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you fine. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The Mat-Su obviously is one of the fastest growing areas in the state, and we do have a lot of road projects, and we just had another fatality on the this past weekend, tragically, on the three most dangerous roads listed in the state, which is the Parks Highway, the Connect Goose Bay, and the former Wasilla Highway. I guess what it comes down to, I'm not opposed to this project. It just comes down to the amount of dollars and how large the capital bill that comes out of the legislature is going to be, because obviously I am saying that we do have a lot of need in this area. And this project is in Juneau is spread over a 12-year project, and the cost could go up on it. But I think that the thing that has me giving somewhat some support to the project is the fact that the projected savings on the ferry system, running the ferries now, and the cost difference between that and then having to replace the ferries sometime in the future is a large amount of money. So I'll make my testimony short. I'm not opposed to the project. Southeast gets a certain amount of the capital dollars that come out, obviously, and if they choose to go forward, if the legislature chooses to fund this, then so be it. We're just looking for our share, as many of the other districts are also. So with that, I'll end my testimony, and if there are any questions, I can try to answer them.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any questions from any of the committee members? No, thank you. Thank you for your testimony this afternoon. We'll go now to A.V.'s Thompson from the Alaska Truckers Association. Mr. Thompson, are you connected to us somehow?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is A.V.'s Thompson. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Trucking Association. The Alaska Trucking Association is a statewide organization representing the interests of our more than 200 member companies from Barrow to Ketchikan. Freight movement represents a large chunk of our economy and impacts all of us each and every day. The simple truth is that if you got it, the truck brought it. I believe there's a handout, Mr. Chairman, that is entitled Overview of the Alaska Trucking Industry. Do you have that?
Yeah, it's in our packets. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. This is an excerpt from a presentation I made earlier, and it focuses on our key issues and concerns. And I'd like to just take a few minutes to cover a couple of these. I don't want to go through all of it, but if there are any questions, I'll just stop me and I'll be happy to answer them. Of course, our first and overriding priority is the gas line. We need not say any more about that. There's a slide there that indicates the national highway system. And we talk about the national highway system as the backbone of our freight network. It's trucks rely on the road system to deliver goods to support all forms of our daily activities. And we need to continue to improve our infrastructure, particularly the national highway system. And along with that, continue to improve, one of our priorities is to eliminate the need for weight restrictions on the Parks Highway. Weight restrictions are those limits that are placed by the Department of Transportation during the spring freeze and thaw period when the highways are most susceptible to damage. DOT limits our ability to, or reduces the weight limits by approximately 15%. Since we can't reduce the weight of the truck, we end up reducing the weight of the payload. And ultimately, weight restrictions cost shippers, receivers, and consumers money. And that reduced load carrying capability increases the cost of transportation. We're also, during that time, we're unable to move heavy construction equipment that can sometimes delay projects. Some years ago, there was about 90 miles of road that needed to be repaired to eliminate weight restrictions. Over those years, that number has been whittled down to close to 50. There's a project in the GO bond package that would reduce that further by another 20 miles. And so we're down to about 30 miles of road. And one of our priorities would be to see that we could fund the repair of that remaining 30 miles so that we could eliminate weight restrictions on that highway. Now, that repair work would not only benefit the freight haulers and the people who are shipping the freight and receiving the freight, it would improve the overall standards of the road and provide for a safer place for people to travel. Roadway maintenance, the M&O budget, is always a concern to us. Maintenance is the key to safe and productive highways. Sometimes it can low level of maintenance can mean the difference between life and death for all motorists. And we feel it's important to continue to fund the maintenance and operation budget through general fund dollars. We have been an advocate expanding the DOTPF State General Fund Capital Projects Program. And particularly now, in light of the projected decreases in federal highway dollars, we feel we need to start doing more for ourselves. We were pleased to see the Transportation Endowment Fund as proposed by the governor. Our criticism of that would be that it's probably not enough, but we feel it's a great start. The projects in the general obligations bonds bill, we feel, need to be funded. We don't take a position as to whether that funding should be general obligation bonds or just general fund dollars. We just feel that the projects need to be funded and need to be completed. There's a Senate Bill 189 that provides some funding for needed bridge repairs and replacements. And there again, at $25 million, it's not nearly enough to begin to address the needs of the state. But we do support Senate Bill 189. A couple of other key issues, of course, are congestion, and Mayor Menard mentioned that his area is the fastest growing in the state, and we certainly can attest to that because of the traffic that our drivers encounter as they travel through the Mat-Su Borough and through Wasilla. There are congestion areas at Denali Park and also on the Seward Highway. Speaking of the Seward Highway, in the GO bonds package, there's a project for the Windy Corner. Windy Corner is a favorite sheep viewing site, and in the summertime, you'll find a number of tourists that have stopped and kind of wandering out on the road trying to get a picture of a sheep to take back to their family in the lower 48. It creates a serious safety problem, and is fortunately has not, to my knowledge, created any catastrophic losses, but at the same time, the potential is there. Access is a concern to us in terms of truck routes, city streets, shopping malls, those kinds of things. Highway safety, we have some shortage of drivers and technicians, and we're trying to deal with that in a number of different ways, working with the various vocational education folks, trying to develop an interest, career interest for the young folks in our business. As I think I've said on previous occasions, that transportation, trucking in Alaska creates some 20,000 jobs. And those are not only just jobs, they're good jobs, and they pay well. The average pay in the trucking industry is above the statewide average, and we're very proud of that. Fuel prices are a concern. Availability of fuel, clean air concerns, and let me just skip to the last part here, a couple of slides here. Keys to keeping Alaska trucking productive. We feel that we need a highway system that encourages development. We need to maintain and enhance the truck size, weight, and permitting productivity gains that have been achieved over the past 20 years. We need to identify necessary transportation improvements for freight movement in Alaska. The Federal Highway Administration has estimated from the years 1998 to the year 2020, freight in Alaska, the freight volume will double. The value of that freight will nearly triple. So we need to begin to think ahead and plan for how we're going to move the freight. And that's without even considering the gas line. Now, if you factor the gas line into that, we are woefully unprepared for that kind of a mega project. Some strategies to make Alaska trucking more productive. Use this transportation endowment fund or variation on that theme to provide some reliable and sustainable and dependable revenue source so that the Department of Transportation can develop a state highway program. We need to fund the projects in the GO bond bill, we need to improve maintenance, and we need to focus our federal funds on the national highway system. Mr. Chairman, that about sums it up. If there are any questions, I'm sorry, I got one more item here. There was a question that was submitted to me that says, how big a priority is the Juneau Road project for the Alaska Trucking Association? And secondly, will it benefit member operations? Well, I'm sure it will come as no surprise that the Alaska Trucking Association supports new roads and new developments. And in this historic time of Alaska's extreme wealth, some of that wealth could be used to fund portions of the Juneau Road and still leave funds to support highway projects in other parts of the state. Having said that, while we support the Juneau Road project, it is not among our highest priority.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Elton? Senator Wilkowski?
No, thanks. Mr. Chair, in fact, I was sitting here thinking of how to thank you for allowing me to sit in and thank the department and the other expert witnesses. Got a 2:30 commitment,
yes,
so
okay, thank you.
Just thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your time this afternoon. We really appreciate you being on the online with us, Mr. Thompson. Do you have anything else, Senator Wilkowski?
No. Okay. No, just for the record, I had a hearing on another bill. Yeah. That's why I
understand and really appreciate you just being here. Senator Cowdery, thank you for being here. This was an overview today. We hadn't intended to make any decisions, and we think it would be wrong for us to do that since we didn't give the kind of notice that we should have if we were going to do that. But I hope that everybody knows a little bit more about the project, what that's going forward, than we knew before we came into the room. And if there is a need for another hearing, we'd certainly be receptive to doing that. With that, as soon as Senator Wilkin sits down, we'll adjourn the meeting. And thank you for being here this afternoon. Thank you, Senator, for coming back.